John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, July 30th, 2012. The Israeli army opens fire on unarmed civilians at a checkpoint in occupied East Jerusalem and on homes in Gaza today. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian medical sources in Jerusalem reported that one Palestinian was killed on Monday at dawn and two others were wounded when Israeli soldiers stationed at a roadblock east of occupied East Jerusalem opened fire at their car under the pretext that they did not heed soldiers' orders for them to stop. The sources said that Akram Badia from Betiel village near the central West Bank city of Ramallah, was moved by the army to the Israeli hospital of Hadassah in Jerusalem, but died of his wounds later on. He was hit by a live round in his head. The two wounded residents were moved by Red Crescent medics to a local hospital in Ramallah. Neither the driver nor the passengers were armed. In related news in Gaza today, the Israeli military opened fire on Palestinian homes and farms in Huzaa, a town east of Khan Yunis. No injuries were reported. The areas in Gaza along the border with Israel east of Khan Yunis are regularly targeted by the Israeli army. Previous attacks have killed and wounded several Palestinians and prevented farmers from reaching their land. Israel reports that the influx of settlers to the West Bank has increased by 4.5%, bringing the total number of illegal Israeli settlers to 350,143, according to the Palestine News Network. This figure, however, excludes areas like Jevan Ze'ev, Nev Yaakov, Ramat Eshkol, and Arman Hanatziv, north and east of Jerusalem, where the Israeli population numbers about 300,000. Israeli Knesset member Yaakov Katz expressed his approval at these numbers, saying, "In the coming 4 years, the number of settlers in the West Bank will reach about 500,000, and after the annexation of East Jerusalem settlements, the number of Jewish settlers will exceed 1 million. And finally, over the weekend, Israeli soldiers and policemen invaded Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Jerusalem after midnight Saturday night and attacked several worshippers while trying to forcefully remove them from the mosque. Clashes were reported and two worshippers from Jerusalem were kidnapped by Israeli forces. And that's all for today from IMEMC News. This was the Monday, July 30th Daily News Roundup from the Occupied Palestinian Territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hussam Cassis and me, Kelly Joyner.
Sunday, NATO is reporting the death of two soldiers of unreported nationality from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in western Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Saturday, NATO is reporting the deaths of two soldiers of unreported nationality from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Friday, NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from a non-combat related injury in an undisclosed location in northern Afghanistan. Is this yet another GI suicide? Pakistan, ongoing. Deliveries of supplies to NATO forces in Afghanistan have been suspended for the past 5 days by threats and action by the Taliban. The supplies to NATO forces were stopped when a driver was killed in an attack on a convoy that was headed for Afghanistan. Pakistan, 30th of July. Another U.S. drone strike killed four alleged militants in Kushali Turical village, North Waziristan. Pakistan, 26th of July. A truck bomb hit a crowded market in northwestern Pakistan on Thursday, killing 11 people, as security concerns led officials to close temporarily a supply route to NATO troops in Afghanistan. Pakistan and Afghanistan, 26th of July. As many as 20 to 30 Afghan National Army personnel crossed the border into Pakistan, invading Kurram Agency. They were driven back by a storm of artillery fire and helicopter gunships. In a previous incident, a missile fired over the border by Afghan troops killed two local tribesmen. Afghanistan, ongoing. The Afghan Ministry of Defense confirms a report of an 11% increase in insurgent activity over the past 3 months. Quote, the Wall Street Journal article cited a NATO official as saying that June had seen the highest number of monthly attacks in almost 2 years, with more than 3,000 incidents, including firefights and bomb blasts. Mr. Barack Obama, Afghanistan can no more be pacified by U.S. troops than Iraq was. There is nothing U.S. troops can do except make it worse. Bring all the troops home today, not 2 years after the election in 2014. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com.
The Eurozone crisis continues, with Spain recently paying the second highest interest rate to support its debt since the founding of the euro currency, with the prospect that Madrid will need an emergency cash infusion soon to avoid crashing. The trouble in Spain comes as the Greek economy, the focus of multiple previous bailout and austerity plans, shrinking 6.9% last year, with a further contraction of 6.7% predicted for 2012. While the so-called Troika, made up of the European Union, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Central Bank, failed to veer away from their austerity policies that have weakened many of the continent's major economies and increased the unemployment rate, militant anti-austerity street protests in Spain, Greece, and other nations speak to widespread and growing opposition to the Eurozone's economic course. Resistance to Europe's austerity measures have been given political expression in Greece, where Syriza, the Greek coalition of the Radical Left Party, now stands as the major opposition force to a newly elected conservative-led government in the Greek parliament. Refusing to meet with representatives of the Troika, Syriza's leader, Alexis Tsipras, declared that no political party should meet with officials of the three institutions, as they've only come to Greece to enforce their catastrophic recipes that have led the country to the cliff's edge. Your reporter spoke with Joanne Landy, co-director of the U.S.-based Campaign for Peace and Democracy, who just returned from a fact-finding trip to Greece, and discusses what lessons U.S. progressives can learn from the Greek political movements resisting austerity.
Unemployment is 25%, and for youth, it's 50%. So you can imagine what that does to a society. As one person told us, society is dying. As far as the privatization or the sell-off of assets, that's very much in contention now. And that's one of the chief things that Tsipras and Syriza are raising. They're protesting the sale of these public assets. And it's not by any means yet a done deal. And it's interesting, the way the government is trying to meet the demands of the Troika, since they're afraid to cut pensions and salaries anymore, is by raising money through the privatization sales. But that's being challenged by Syriza, and I think it's the whole scenario is now an open question of what's going to happen next.
Joanne, tell us about the Syriza party, its rise in recent elections, as well as its program. What has attracted such a large amount of new support for the party and a rejection of the two major parties?
Well, they have had a meteoric ascent. They went from getting typically 3-4% of the vote to getting 27% of the vote in the June 16th or June 17th elections. The reason that they got this incredible burst of support was because they were the only party that was saying no to the memorandum and at the same time had roots in the emerging social movements that have taken place across Greece for the last few years. And what people repeatedly told us was that Syriza had credibility because it had been there when the students were out on strike, when the occupation was going on in the squares, when workers were on strike. Syriza was always there. And they combined the participation in these movements with parliamentary representation of the demands of those movements. And I think it's that combination. It was really very exciting for me and Tom to see. We certainly wish we could have something like that in this country, where you would have not anti-politics of activists, but a complementarity between movements in the streets and parliamentary representation.
From the point of view of having a pragmatic program that can go a long way to fixing the enormous economic depression in Greece, what is Syriza saying in terms of how they can address, how they can viably address the nightmare economics in Greece?
Well, that's, of course, the $64 million or billion-dollar question. And we frankly didn't get complete answers to that question. We know that they would nationalize the banks, that they would take control of some of the industries, that they would roll back the cuts in pensions, the firings of public employees, and so forth. But how would they do that, and what relationship would they have to Europe? I don't know. And I tried to find out. We tried to find out when we were there. We understand that they have economists and political leaders meeting to discuss this. I mean, you have to understand, this is a party with 15,000 members, which is very small, that's been catapulted into this position of potential power and responsibility. But what's encouraging about them is that they're willing to go against the stream. They're willing to reject the memorandum and the troika that's being imposed upon them, and to simultaneously do the best they can at home, and also, and I think this is key, to reach out for a new kind of Europe. They know that over the long run, they can't really solve these problems in Greece alone, that you can't, so to speak, have socialism in one country. So they've, you know, sent people around to different countries of Europe. They, right now, have called for the current government to stop talks with the Troika and to convene a European summit for a different way to respond to austerity throughout Europe.
What are the lessons that you found could be useful for progressive movements here in the United States from the activists in the resistance movement to austerity in Greece, if you could put it in a nutshell?
We really have to break out of this two-party system in which neither one of them is structurally capable of representing the movement. And although we have many more electoral obstacles than countries in Europe, which generally have proportional representation, I don't think we can let those obstacles stand in our way. And although we're not going to create a party overnight, Tom Harrison wrote an article in the for New Politics that's online talking about how progressives and the left need to make a declaration of independence from the Democratic Party. And I think that's the lesson that I would take away from this, the immediate lesson, is not that we can create a party, but that people who understand that this is a dead end say so, and then buttress their arguments with the exciting first steps that are being taken in Greece.
That was Joanne Landy, co-director of the U.S.-based Campaign for Peace and Democracy. Find links to more analysis of the Eurozone crisis and resistance movements on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
On the 28th of July, thousands of people, many from communities damaged by natural gas fracking, rallied at the U.S. Capitol, then marched on the American Natural Gas Association, and finally the American Petroleum Institute, or API.
The water's on fire!
The indulgence of
one of the speakers at the rally at the Capitol before the march joked that the natural gas fracking industry must have gotten their exemptions from environmental laws by drilling a well from a rig inside the Washington Monument to the House and Senate office buildings with which to inject cash instead of hydrofracking chemicals to get that exemption. He began by pointing to the Washington Monument.
It looks a little bit like a drill rig. And I think in the middle of the night, when no one was paying attention, Aubrey McClendon and Timor Pickens, they somehow got a drill rig up inside of that Washington Monument. And they drilled a well. And they have a horizontal well bore sticking all the way up underneath that building over there. And they're injecting not carcinogenic chemicals, not neurotoxins, not volatile organic compounds, but money.
Yeah!
And cash. A lot of money. Now, if you want to outbid them, if anybody here has got a spare $747 million, which is the amount of money that they spent getting the exemption to one law, just one, $750 million for the exemption to the Safe Drinking Water Act.
There was also a speaker from the Blackfeet Nation on how hydrofracking wells are damaging their land, which shockingly mirrors how tar sands oil extraction is doing damage to the Lakota.
I am a proud member of the Blackfoot Confederacy. We are the indigenous land caretakers of the headwaters of the North American continent. We live where sacred sites to us, practice our way of life, are at stake from the fracking. I come here today and I represent over 60,000 members of the Blackfoot Confederacy in Montana, Alberta, and Saskatchewan. The oil and gas companies right now are targeting the Blackfeet Reservation in Montana, the Blood Reserve in Canada, the North Pagan in Canada, and the Blackfoot proper in Gishin, Alberta. We have oil companies bringing in with them drug dealers, prostitution, a threat to our very cultural way of life.
The first stop of the march was the American Natural Gas Association, which lobbies for gas frackers. Several folks had brought contaminated well water, which had been filled with chemicals by nearby fracking projects.
Here it comes.
That's somebody's drinking water.
That's drinking water contaminated by fracking from a well in Butler, Pennsylvania. This is supposed to be drinking water from a well, but look at it. This is drinking water? We're supposed to drink this stuff? Yet we're handling it here in toxic protection suits as toxic waste. If I were to take one of these bottles of this so-called drinking water and go inside that office and dump it under carpet, I could be arrested for dumping a hazardous substance. And yet here it is, this well water that somebody's supposed to drink. The march culminated when all the marchers, thousands strong, swarmed in on the American Petroleum Institute, the notorious lobbyist for the oil and gas industry that was once known mostly for raiding motor oil, now is known mostly for bribing congressmen. A mock gas drilling rig was erected in front of API and then torn down while another group of people sat down blocking the doors. The police didn't even attempt to interfere with this siege. It lasted about half an hour.
Set up in front of the American Petroleum Institute, or in this case, a gas fracking rig.
During the siege, many of the marchers chanted, "The water, the water, the water is on fire. We don't need no fracking. Let the corporations burn." One of the most amazing things that has resulted from natural gas fracking has been that in many places, enough gas has leaked into well water or occasionally municipal water that it comes out people's taps, giving water that can literally be ignited with a cigarette lighter, with a gas burning in a flame over the tap while the water heads down towards the drain. And here's what people had to say about that outside the offices of the American Petroleum Institute.
The water! The water! The water's on fire!
The climax of the entire protest may have been the moment when the mock gas fracking rig set up in front of the American Petroleum Institute was torn down.
Stop the frack attack!
You're about to
take it down!
Is a form of natural gas drilling, an alternative to oil, cause the oil kept spilling, bringing jobs to small towns, so everybody's willing. People turn on the lights and the drillers make a killing.
Water goes into the pipe into the ground, the pressure cranks fishes 7,000 feet down, the cracks release the gas that powers your town, that will's frack, yeah,
totally fracked. But there's more in the water than just H2O. Toxic chemicals help to make the fluid flow. With names like benzene and formaldehyde, you better keep them far away from the water supply.
The drillers say the fishes are a mile below the groundwater pumped into American homes. But don't tell it to the residents of Sublet Wayo. That water's fracked. We're talking benzene.
What's going on with all this fracking going on? I think we need some facts to come to light. I know we want our energy, but nothing ever comes for free. I think my water's on fire tonight.
So it all goes back to 2005. Bush said gas drillers didn't have to comply with the Safe Drinking Water Act before too long. It was frack, baby, frack until the break of dawn.
With the EPA out, it was up to the states, but they didn't have the money to investigate. Sick people couldn't prove fracking was to blame. All the while water wells were going up in flames.
Cause it's hard to contain all the methane released. It can get into the air, it can get into the streams. It's a greenhouse gas worse than CO2. Fracking done wrong could lead to climate change too.
Now it's not that drillers should never be fracking, but the current regulation is severely lacking. Reduce the toxins contained, the gas and wastewater, and the people will get sick and the planet will get hotter.
What the frack is going on with all this fracking going on? I think we need some facts to come to light. I know we want our energy, but nothing ever comes for free. I think our water's on fire tonight.
The 28th of July was a national day of action against destructive extractive industries. While thousands marched in D.C. against natural gas fracking, over 50 people with mountain mobilization in West Virginia marched under the largest mountaintop removal coal mine in Appalachia and shut it down with direct action. This is the Hobet Mine, owned by Patriot Coal, which has filed for bankruptcy. The mine shutdown turned rough. Protesters used normal civil disobedience tactics and were met with violence and $500,000 bail being demanded for 20 arrestees. A tree sitter was threatened with a chainsaw that could be used to cut down the tree and kill the tree sitter. While someone is in a tree inside the mine's blasting safety radius, blasting is illegal, so that shuts down blasting operations. Much to the distress of mine bosses, this tactic has been used before at other strip mines in the mountains. More protesters locked themselves to a rock truck, needed to haul away the land miners call overburden and dump it over the sides for a valley fill. I assume they were among the 20 people arrested. Two more people were arrested in Kiwanis State Forest, not even at the mine, though they were later released. Here are some statements from organizers about just how bad the violence got. Quote, "We are doing everything we can to get Dustin Steele out of jail after he was beaten by authorities yesterday." Quote, "Urgent report from jail support. Our arrestees are being held in a field in Danville, West Virginia. Jail support was put up against the wall and told they had to leave the area. Angry miners are in the area and we are worried about safety." Quote, "Folks who got off the mine site without being arrested being harassed, chased, locked in by miners. They are still on the road being chased by miners in trucks that are making driving difficult." That's right. People who are not cops were engaging in car chases trying to catch or forcibly stop protesters. Fortunately, their heavy trucks were no match for lighter vehicles driven by protesters, all of whom appear to have escaped from this ugly tactic. As of Monday, the 30th of July, 20 protesters are still being held in Western Regional Jail in Barboursville, West Virginia. It will take $25,000 per arrestee or $500,000 to bail them out.